Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002. And it's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week we speak to Joanna Blythman. She's the author and investigative journalist, author of Swallow This, The Food Industry's Darkest Secrets, and also, on a lighter note, What to Eat. She's got some tips that she thinks should be written on your kitchen wall. Also, we speak to Kevin Wilson. He's a Bristol student who's just come back from a holiday in Georgia. No, not Georgia, USA. Georgia, in the Caucasus Mountains, just by the Black Sea. And finally, the latest instalment in the interview with JFK assassin, one of the Chicago Mafia hitmen, James Files. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. You can even use the national do-it.org website for volunteers. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Joanna Blythman, and I'm an investigative food journalist. I've written 7 books about food issues, and the latest one is called Swallow This. The strapline is dishing up the food industry's darkest secrets.
Well, I suppose the obvious question is, what are the food industry's darkest secrets, Joanna?
Well, it's a bit of the case of where do you want to start? I mean, there are so many things going. The subject of Swallow This is not unprocessed food, i.e. whole ingredients that you would just buy to make a meal with. I've been looking at processed food, so food that comes from factories. And when you turn over the label, you probably find that there's a couple of sentences or even a very long paragraph in the ingredients listing. And that's what I've been looking at. And what I found there is a number of things that basically the label doesn't give the whole story of the ways in which those basic raw materials have been transformed, in my opinion, for the worst behind the scenes. Over the last 10 years, there's been a major initiative in the food industry called Clean Label. And what they've tried to do is clean up product labels so they read better and sound as if the products are more natural than they actually are. So whereas what happened in the 80s and 90s, I think that people gradually started reading product labels and they were disconcerted by what they saw. So they would read things like flavorings, colorings, and mono and diglycerides of fatty acids, carboxymethylcellulose, a whole lot of ingredients and additives that sounded straight out of the science lab. And they are actually quite close to the science lab. And people lost confidence in that kind of food. So the food industry kind of went into a bit of a panic mode and said, okay, we are going to have to, you know, allay these fears. But instead of actually changing the product formulation, which they're really unable to do because their whole profit model is predicated on using a lot of high-tech ingredients and all the skills and dark arts in the food technologist's book to transform cheap ingredients, make them look better than they are. So they came up instead with a strategy, which is Clean Label. And Clean Label is about changing names of food ingredients or additives to make them sound better. I mean, just to give you one very simple example of this, because it's a bit hard to take in the absence of an example. If you pick up a product and it says on the back of it that it contains rosemary extract, you might think, well, that sounds delicious. You know, that sounds like something that was made by slow food peasants up a Tuscan mountainside. Actually, rosemary extract is just another word for preservative. What happens is that in a, they have a very elaborate system for taking dried rosemary, processing it using many physical, chemical methods. And from this, you extract two chemicals which have the effect, which are antioxidants, that is, they have the effect of increasing shelf life. So this rosemary extract goes into food. It the word preservative doesn't need to appear on the label. This substance has really very little at this stage to do any longer with what you or I might think of as fresh rosemary. It doesn't smell of fresh rosemary. It doesn't taste of rosemary. It's simply there to extend the shelf life of the food. So that's a very one example of clean label. Another one is carrot concentrate. Carrot concentrate sounds like something you might, you know, buy in the health food shop, you know, on the basis it was going to be a tonic or good for you or something. But in fact, carrot concentrate is just a clean label coloring, as is beetroot extract. And, you know, guess what? They're not contributing to your five a day, but we're all kind of, the food industry is trying to create this impression that there's nothing in processed food that you really wouldn't use at home. It wants to give customers what's called that kitchen cupboard guarantee of naturalness. But actually the food and the way it's made doesn't really fit that bill. So clean label does the trick of creating this halo of naturalness and goodness that isn't really justified.
What about the food industry? Because in many parts of our world nowadays, particularly here in Europe and the United States, there's a very strong corporate lobby to tell the regulators, I suppose what I'm really saying is to deregulate. I wonder what the food lobby is like.
Well, food lobby is, Big Food or Big Food Inc. is enormously powerful, as you might expect. And you've got to think that a lot of the companies that are actively involved in the food industry are actually really belong to the larger group of the chemical industry. They sit in with that group very neatly. And these people, these companies are seasoned lobbyists. So, you know, in Brussels, for example, there, I think last time I read, there was something like 30,000 full-time lobbyists based in Brussels. Now, and their job is to lobby the European Commission mainly, but also the European Parliament. And then these aren't all food lobbyists, but a large number of them are for the food and drinks industry. So their job is to basically knock the doors of the bureaucrats, civil servants who are drafting regulations and say to them, look, you know, you don't really need to be too strict. You can trust us. So there's now very much more self-regulation. And the other thing is, of course, there's the revolving door. So there's this sort of very friendly relationship between the supposed regulators and the companies they're meant to be regulating. And they obviously, the transfer between the two in terms of jobs and employment is quite remarkable. So there's that. There's also the issue of the sort of scientific committees who are charged with looking after public health and regulating this industry. Until I started researching for Swallow This, I don't think I'd realized. I had this kind of comforting idea that these were independent scientists who would be sitting down and making a really sort of wise decision on the basis of all the evidence. But very many of them come from the industry they're supposed to be regulating. So they're very much committed to that industry. And the ones that aren't actually already in the food industry are in their day job, often taking grants or revenue from these companies. So, then there will be some independent people who are trying to do their best, but these really powerful corporations, global corporations mainly, are very threatening. So they'll say, well, you know, if you try and restrict our right to use pesticide X or additive Y, then, you know, we'll challenge this in court. We'll give you a really hard time. And this is no one in either the commission or amongst the politicians. It's very, very hard for them to resist that pressure. So there's a tendency just to draft legislation that's fairly meaningless. If you come down to a more specific example of the so-called regulation of the food industry, if you look at these big food factories, which are churning out things like ready meals, food manufacturers. I mean, I visited many of them, and it's a real eye-opener. You know, they're these big box, faceless big box warehouses that you get on industrial estates. You know, they have no windows, no one can see in. And how those companies work is that they largely self-regulate. They have a system now called HACCP, and HACCP is about predicting hazards that could occur, such as microbiological hazards, food safety hazards, and then putting in place systems that are meant to prevent these, and then having a sort of tick boxing system for making sure that these things have been done. So when you go into these factories, which are really horrible places to work, and my heart really does go out to anyone who ends up working in them, because they're absolutely soul-destroying and low-paid, I should say, and often staffed by migrants who are just desperate for a job, who are working long, long shifts that are basically inhuman. In this day and age, people shouldn't be asked to work like this. But you go into these factories and you find that, there's no one actually doing any checking. As long as someone ticks the box and fills in the bits of paper that create the paper trail to show supposed safety, then it's not happening. So, you know, this is why it's really interesting when you get things like animal welfare groups or independent journalists who get in at a time when they're not expecting, see what's really going on. And there's all sorts of things going on, like relabeling old meat to make it look fresher than it is, that sort of thing. And one of the things that I came across when I was researching Swallow This was trade unions who are trying to, it's a notoriously difficult industry to try and unionize, because there's so many people who are there for a short time or come from abroad, or, the management makes it very difficult for them to do so. But they're saying that basically in these factories, they can expect a visit from officialdom once in a blue moon, was a phrase that I came across. In other words, it hardly ever happens. So this is why you get things like horse meat, because this whole edifice that's created to convince us that our food chain is very safe, very transparent and really well policed is a really nice, comforting idea, but it just isn't the case.
Now, this horse meat scandal two or three years ago, has anything actually been done to make sure that can't happen again?
Well, very good question. As far as I know, no. I mean, I think they got to the bottom of, and there's always a sort of somebody at the bottom of the line who may or may not be the real cause, gets the problem. And I think it was very convenient to sort of blame some distant operation in Romania, you know. But the fact is, there were so many links in that food chain that I have no confidence at all after horse meat that couldn't happen again. And another kind of thing that makes it more likely to happen again is that there's a large amount of sort of integration of these companies. So when you go to the supermarket and you see all these products that look different, and you think, gosh, they must all be made by different companies, and there must be an awful lot of companies, but actually there aren't. In Britain, there are relatively few food manufacturing outfits, and they tend to be working round the clock, 24 hours a day, and they're doing similar-ish products for several retailers. So it's quite common to go into a food factory and find that, on one line it's Sainsbury's, and the other line it's Morrison's, and then, once that shift's over, it'll be Marks and Spencer's and Tesco. That's quite normal. So what it means is that if you have a problem like contaminated meat, or a problem to do with, say, a pathogen that's crept into some food, is very likely to be spread around a lot of retailers in record time. And this is what happens when you see things like product recalls. You'll often see that, first of all, it'll start off with something like Tesco's hamburgers being recalled because of this. And then you find that actually it's spread to Asda, and it's also in Waitrose and M&S and so on. And this is because so many, that the same factories are basically making the same food, and they're all buying. Because the supermarkets are really screwing them down and saying we want this product cheap, they're looking at the manufacturers are looking at what they can do to make it profitable for them. And one, the key way to do that is to cut their ingredient costs. They're always looking to cut ingredient costs, because that way, that's the only way they can make product profit when they're when their customers are major retailers.
Okay, I mean, you're talking about these brands we see in the supermarket often being owned by one of these big companies, like maybe Unilever or Kraft, being behind a lot of these products and owning the brands, really. It's a brand that they sell. It's a brand that they try and advertise. You're supposed to feel good about the brand and go in, and that makes your hand sort of reach out and grab it, put it in your supermarket trolley. But what about these companies like Unilever and Kraft? Am I right in thinking that you know, there are some small food manufacturers, but when, if they become successful, that one of these big firms, and maybe you could just tell us who these big firms who are behind these brands, come along and just buy them out?
Yeah, well, this is what happens is the large companies, I mean, you know, when you buy a product, you see the name on the label. You don't understand that it's owned by this big distant company. But that is actually what's going on. So supposing hypothetically I had a good idea and I produce this really great chocolate, organic chocolate, and I was doing really well with it, and I was getting it in all the shops, and I was beginning to have a really nice product there. Would be very attractive for a company to come, a larger company, to say, okay, let's acquire this company. Now, I mean, this happened with Green and Blacks. Green and Blacks, as I remember it, can't remember actually who bought that over, but that was a brand bought over by a larger company. And what it does is it kind of, they use small innovative companies as new product development. So they sit and they watch and see which ones are working, which independent good ideas are working, and then they say, "Okay, let's own it. Let's us buy it out." So, if you're a brand, if you're a big company, you buy out a small brand. But what happens often, and the large retailers, the supermarkets, do this all the time, they'll list, i.e., stock a product, a new product. They'll take it from the independent company. The company will be really pleased that it's got that supermarket listing. It'll go on the shelves. It'll sell quite well. And then basically the supermarket will turn around to its own label suppliers, that is the faceless manufacturers who make products for it already, and say, right, we want you to make an own label one for us because we can make more money on it. And the other point about using a faceless own label manufacturer is that if they don't give you, make the product for the price you want, you can just go to another faceless own label company and say, okay, we want you to manufacture it instead. So at least the brands, i.e. the companies with the names that we recognize, have some leverage with supermarkets, because, you know, the consumers to a certain extent are loyal to brands. So they'll say, well, actually, I really like that name, you know, Cherry Farms or whatever it is.
And it's actually interesting, Green and Black you mentioned, because just looking it up, it was bought out by Cadbury's, who were themselves then bought out by one of the really massive international firms called Kraft. Can you run through who are these big guys that we don't see their logos and we don't see any of their people there in the supermarket when we're buying our food?
Yeah, would have been things like Kraft, Unilever, PepsiCo. I mean, the way I think of it is, It's like Russian dolls. You know those Russian doll sets you used to get where there's a big doll and all the little ones inside? It's a bit like that. And what the consumers see is the little one and think, oh, that's nice. That's a nice independent company and I like that brand and, you know, it's good quality. And they don't realise it's been acquired by the bigger brand.
What about your other book, What to Eat? That sounds a bit more positive. Rather than looking at the darker sides of processed food, what should we be eating?
Yeah, well, I mean, What to Eat, what it does is it looks at categories of food and it says, okay, how do you tell the difference between the good ones and the bad ones? What is it really worth paying for and what is it not? So by category, almost like a recipe book, it goes through, you know, things like meat, fish, eggs, you know, dairy products, fruit and vegetables, and explains, you know, how to tell the good ones from the bad ones.
But how do you do that? Say with something like fish, you know, all of us pretty much eat fish, even some vegetarians eat fish. So how do you tell about where to get the fish from? I mean, it might also, of course, you know, one of the other aspects of all of this is we don't want to spend more than we have to on food. And we really need to know when are we sort of cutting down on what we're spending to such an extent that we may be actually damaging our health.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think the thing is that some people are so hard up that they just don't have a choice. And that's shocking in our society that in a, you know, affluent Northern Hemisphere country that there should be so many people so desperately short of money that they really have no food choice.
And they have to go to a food bank and take what they're given, some people.
You know, which is just totally unacceptable. And there are, and I'm very concerned about the way that food banks are becoming the new normal. They should not exist. However, of people who aren't stony broke, I think most people are sort of the thing, well, I'll spend a bit more if I'm convinced of what I'm buying. But if I'm just paying for a label or some pretentious bit of marketing, I'm not into that. And so it's always sort of sorting out the marketing spraff, as we say in Scotland, from the genuine hard facts that allow you to make a decision about food. It depends on the category of food you're looking at. And there is specific information in What to Eat for each category of food. So, for example, in the bread section, I explain to people how to tell the difference between highly unnatural factory-made Charlie Wood bread with all the additives and all the indigestible proteins in it that are really quite likely to make you give you some sort of food intolerance, not to say fat, and the difference, how to tell the difference between that and a well-crafted loaf. I explain how they're made and how they're different. So, I mean, that bread is a very good example because a lot of people will say to me, but, you know, I can understand that a lot of supermarket bread's rubbish, but, you know, you're telling me to buy a loaf that costs £3 a pop. Are you joking? Are you serious? So what I say to these people is, no, this isn't a sort of elitist obsession here. If I explain to you how it's made and the difference, you will understand why you might be then prepared to buy a better loaf. You know, eat less of it, don't waste anything, really enjoy it, and so on, and the kind of bonus that might have for your health. So really what to eat is goes into very specific sort of information depending on the category of food we're looking at. And it obviously covers broad general things like whether or not organic is worthwhile spending money for, you know, a lot of animal welfare in there, the difference between, say, barn eggs and free range eggs. I mean, for me, that, you know, there's particularly given the fact that there isn't so great a difference in price, I definitely say to people, as a minimum, buy free range. But really, again, unless you're really strapped for cash, organic eggs are relatively cheap food.
Now, you mentioned that. Is it worth paying a bit extra for organic? What's the answer to that?
Yeah, it is the answer. You know, if you care about animal welfare, if you care about the environment, if you want to buy if you want, and there are, for example, in if you're worried about pesticide residues in your food, and we should be worried about those and what they're doing, not just to the environment, but to human health. There's another example. Also, if you do buy processed food, then that's not to say there isn't bad processed organic food. There most certainly is. But as a bare minimum, the list of approved additives for organic food is tiny compared to the number that can be used in I won't use the word conventional food, but in chemically produced food.
Now, we all like to use fresh food if possible. What about the idea of canned food and frozen food?
Well, I think these need to be separated out. I mean, I think frozen food is mainly a good thing, given the proviso there would be that, you know, we're talking about things like fresh spinach, fresh raspberries. We're talking about making your own stock and freezing it. I'm not talking about going to the cheapest freezer food center and loading up with a load of highly, highly processed, cheap processed food and sticking it in the freezer. But I think if you look on it as a way of preserving food, then freezing is great. My freezer, I don't have a very big freezer, but I do have a sort of small freezer, and in it I would keep things like chicken stock, organic meat. I make some ice cream, some breadcrumbs so that I hadn't wasted bread, that kind of thing. Canned food, I mean, there are issues to do with canned food, mainly to do with the linings inside the can and the chemicals used to make these linings. My feeling here is that none of us are going to stop using canned food entirely, but I would be unhappy to think that someone was living only on canned food because you are more exposed to those chemicals. But, I mean, cans that I would have in the house quite regularly would be things like tin tomatoes. I get through quite a few cans of coconut milk. But, you know, you can even cut down the cans you have. I mean, for example, a lot of people will buy canned beans. And I do understand the thing, you know, because you don't have to, the appeal, because you don't have to soak the beans, cook them and so on. But just the other day, this week, in fact, I decided I was going to buy chickpeas, soak them and boil them and make my own hummus. And I did that. And the difference between those chickpeas that I had, you know, soaked and boiled, and those sort of smelly kind of chickpeas that smell a bit like the hamster's cage, you know, those kinds of tin foods was huge. So I'd say that keep canned foods down to a minimum. And just returning briefly to the subject of food banks, I was quite horrified to learn that typically, an emergency rations parcel for a family of four can contain up to 22 cans of food. And that information was given to me by an NGO that's very active in food poverty. And they were saying, and they were telling me about recipes for food given out by food banks, which involved things like a tin of pre-cooked mince, a tin of pre-chopped carrots cut up and put into that mince, and then powdered mashed potato on top, and this becomes a food bank cottage pie. And I must say, my heart sinks there, because no, we shouldn't in this day and age be living on that sort of diet of canned processed food.
That was Joanna Blythman. She's the author of Swallow This, The Food Industry's Darkest Secrets, and an investigative journalist. She also wrote What to Eat. And next week, she'll be telling us some important things that we should be writing up on our kitchen wall.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, I'm joined by Kevin Wilson here, who's based here in Bristol. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Kevin, tell us a little bit about your recent trip, because you went somewhere. I mean, most of us, when we're thinking about somewhere to go on holiday, we wouldn't think about going to the Black Sea, especially the east side of the Black Sea, which is like virtually into the Caucasus.
Yes, yeah. There's a lot of things labelled Caucasus where I went. I went to Georgia.
Now, when you said Georgia a few weeks ago that you were off there, I thought, oh, he's going to the States.
Yeah, a lot of people did, which is, I feel like that's a more attractive one, for a lot of tourists.
Why Georgia, though?
Georgia because essentially it was a family holiday. I got dragged along and I thought, well, it's a part of the world that no one really visits and why not?
So you're on the east of the Black Sea there. Now, this is the Caucasus, kind of at the bottom of the Caucasus. It's in between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea. Russia is to your north. The south is east is Iran. The southwest is Turkey. So you're kind of right near the Middle East, in fact. So anyway, just tell us what kind of country it was when you first arrived. What impression?
When you first arrive, we went to the capital, Tbilisi. And it's been strangely developed. They hosted sort of youth Olympics, in a sense. And so there's a few sort of glass buildings, and it looks rather shiny. It looks trying to be Western, but you've still got the old city everywhere. All these sort of large stone buildings, which have a lot of history to them. So I don't know what to say. It's not exactly first world, but... It's sort of getting there.
It's getting... Okay, so what you've got is a kind of old, ancient culture, really, with some up-to-date, westernised, big money kind of arriving on the scene.
Slapped in the middle of it.
It sounds a bit... Actually, it sounds a bit like bad planning decisions. But anyway, so did you get to see outside Tbilisi or...?
Yes, so essentially we went... I went on a walking holiday and it was... we had a guide. So we went out into the mountains. Unfortunately, a lot of the time we had to go the long way around, thanks to Russia.
So hang on, what's the relationship like between Georgia and Russia?
Georgia used to have a nice relationship with Russia, especially when Stalin was around. And Stalin himself was Georgian, and the Soviets came in. It was part of the big Soviet empire.
Since then, they've had their independence. I'm imagining they're saying, well, those nasty, like a lot of the ex-British colonies, those nasty colonialists, well, we don't like them anymore.
Yeah, well, we are going up through the mountains, you see all these small villages, and during the Soviet Empire, a lot of factories are put up to give these people jobs. And since then, that need, the supply from Georgia has sort of gone down. It's diminished. And all these factories have closed down. These people have lost their jobs and income.
God, sounds like South Wales.
Yeah, this the comparison I was thinking of making. But because of that, the younger generation seem to take a rather negative stance on current Russia. That being said, they're not the only people to invade them. There's a lot of heritage from Turkey, from Persia, from many Arab countries, and including the Mongols. There's a lot of stuff through here.
It's a very important part of the world strategically, kind of militarily. A lot of eyes are on the Caucasus as a route between Russia and the Middle East. A lot of the Western powers want to kind of stop that route. But anyway, look, let's get back away from the politics for a bit. What about the temperatures and what about the countryside?
The countryside itself, it's beautiful. Once you're sort of away from the big cities and you've got all these very quaint little villages, they've got these lovely tall stone towers, which are originally built to defend against the Mongols. Because, you know, they'll go over these mountains and think, oh, no, these sort of impregnable tiny villages. And then once you look up, you've got these very snowy peaks, a huge mountains of 5,000 metres of tops.
Wow. So, yeah, well, that sounds almost like the Alps.
Yeah, it is, but very different.
So you were walking, near the snowy tops of these mountains?
Unfortunately not. I feel tourism is, for walking holidays, is only starting to develop, so trained guides is, you know, lacking.
So you had someone showing you around?
There was a lot of times we end up with local guides, people from the villages who live there, who walk up these mountains, you know, a few times a day with relative ease, just taking us up, and we're all panting and, you know, suffering from the low oxygen, and they're there with a bunch of flowers they're going to bring home and nothing else.
Okay, well, okay, let's go back to the city. What was Tbilisi? I mean, actually, life in the evenings, did you go out in the evenings, that sort of thing?
It's very safe. It's very safe, which was very unexpected. Yeah, they said, you know, stay out about until half midnight because that's when all the drunks.
What was it like compared to an average evening, weekday evening in Bristol, say?
Bristol coming out, it's sort of lots of drunk students. was wandering about the place throwing up. But I'm out about 11:30. I'm coming from a big meal, Georgian wine and everything. And there's children everywhere, people out with their families, because it's safe and it feels very nice, very welcoming, you know.
What about temperatures, though? I mean, this is one of the things we always want when we're going on holiday. You might go somewhere which is a little bit interesting, maybe off the beaten track, but it's got to be nice weather.
It's absolutely sweltering.
You've gone in the middle of August, which is bound to be one of the hottest months.
Yeah, so there was preparation for dehydration and things. But yeah, actually, though, most of the time I spend in the mountains, so it's relatively cool. I don't know if it's consistent.
How did you cope with the temperatures?
Drinking water. That's what I spell what I can do.
And is it safe drinking tap water and stuff there?
No, it was all bottled water.
All bottled water. Oh, gosh, someone's going to make a fortune out of that like they're doing here. Did you manage to get to the Black Sea coast at all?
No, we didn't, which was unfortunate. I was thinking with the water, it's rather unfortunate because one of the other downsides to... They have, I think, relatively poor water sanitation, which means you can't flush your toilet rolls away. So right. There's these sort of buckets full of rather smelly paper.
Right, so they haven't actually got proper drainage.
No.
Oh, yes, this is one of the things I can remember reading years ago, that the British Empire, when the British Empire went and appeared somewhere, the first thing they'd do is dig drains. And everyone would be so overjoyed that they'd embrace the British, at which point the British would then start exploiting them. You know, so they haven't obviously got that far in Georgia. That's a bit of a shame if they haven't got a decent drainage system. That sounds very, it does sound very backward.
You can get what you get. But apart from that, very hospitable.
What about the people?
The people... Oh, my word. I read these sort of tourist guides. You're like, the people are friendly and welcoming and always smiley, and we get there and the waiters are just, they're fed up faces. I mean, they do their job well, but it's...
They're a bit hostile to the tourists?
Not at all, but it's just...
They're just kind of going
once through... again, with the developments of tourism, they don't have this tourist welcoming persona. They just do their job. So... It's not all smiles, you know, are all around, but...
How about getting around?
Getting around, unfortunately, I can't comment on that because we had a bus.
Oh, right. An ordinary bus? Or were you sort of...
A bus for...
Tour bus type
yes,
thing?
Yes, for the guide. It was a rather fancy minibus.
And what the roads like?
Tbilisi is the capital, so...
As bad as the potholes in Bristol?
Well, at some point the roads just end, right? They develop the road very well. Until they stop, until they it's just a cut-off point. And immediately it's a roller coaster.
Okay, what about the architecture?
The architecture comes from everywhere. It looks rather Asian, but because of all the invasions. But around the place you see these churches. There's a lot of churches.
Are they like the kind of Russian Orthodox onion dome churches?
No, they're straight peaks. But once you go inside, I think Russian Orthodox has white walls, and this is very much more, traditional Orthodox. My knowledge is not great on it, but there's giant, lovely murals of Jesus and all the saints, because, yeah, of course. And a lot of the churches seem to have relics, so old bones and clothing and images, but yeah.
What about religion? Because that wasn't really favoured in the Soviet time, was it?
No, and you get this sort of where Christians had to hide, like during the
So where did the Christians hide?
What's interesting is that they decided to go back to the churches all the way at the top of mountains, very far out, which were originally built
in the woods, basically, off the beaten track,
to hide from the Soviets because they refused to worship at home, which was interesting.
So you're thinking of moving to Georgia now?
No.
All right, Kevin Wilson, thanks very much for sharing your trip to Georgia with us.
That's right.
Thanks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
I've got my briefcase, gun case in my right hand. I've got my left hand over by my coat pocket. I got a Colt 45 there.
JFK assassin, one of the Chicago Mafia hitmen. James Files.
I've got it fully loaded with 6 rounds on it. It's ready to go if I need it.
Oh, you reversed your jacket.
I've already reversed my jacket. When I picked up the gun case, I reversed my jacket, no plaid side. I got the poplin gray material on the outside. I took the fedora I had shoved down in the sleeve of it, snapped it out, put it back on my head, and I walked away, carrying the briefcase and my .45 inside my coat pocket.
How long did it take to do that?
Just a few seconds. Don't take long.
Is that any chance that that's you walking along right there?
I have the blow it for you. 15, 30 seconds.
Looking at that, I couldn't say it's me, but I'm saying you can see somebody there, basically speaking. It could have been.
Is that the direction you took?
Yeah.
You walked back towards the deposit.
Right. Going in that direction.
And there was nobody around you at that, even at that point?
At that point, there's nobody around me. I'm not going to let nobody get close to me at that point. Because, like I say, somebody might try to grab me. They might want to pull a gun on me. I'm looking at people. Somebody turns around. If they make the wrong move, if I see somebody pulling a weapon, they're going to be shot. If I see somebody...
This is a little retaining wall.
Mm-hmm.
And right on the other side of it's a sidewalk. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a little, a garden patch, a little flower garden thing. And then that road, the little road that runs in front of the depository.
Right. That's the one that comes at the dead end down here?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
And that's right where you were walking.
That's
you,
right where I was walking.
You on the south side or the north side?
That's I don't remember.
Don't remember. Okay.
All I remember is I'm walking and I'm watching over my shoulder. I'm trying to see if anybody's coming at me.
You have a Mormon picture there?
Yeah.
Well, if I could later.
Think it here. Yeah, no, we might as well look at this right here. Is that the tree you're talking about?
Yep. And you can see the branches from back over here coming right down over the wall.
And it's the vicinity where you were standing?
Right there.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember which side of the tree you were on? Was it to your left or your right?
I could be mistaken. I believe that, no, the tree was to my right. It had to be to the right. The tree was to my right. I didn't want to have the tree in the way of my left.
That's correct.
Okay.
Or
you can't see the sign here, but the sign is right on down here.
Did you ever notice those people?
There was people out there. I remember more people than that being around. I don't know where they all disappeared to. But I remember people falling down, laying down, jumping down, whatever you want to call it. People moving to get out of the way, going in other directions. Some standing around pointing, and who they were, what they were wearing, I couldn't even start to tell you.
What about these two guys right here? Did you ever notice them, or did any of those look familiar, or did any of those look like some of those guys you saw that you recognized?
They could have been.
It's hard to tell.
Yeah, it's hard to tell from this here. But like I say, when the motorcade come, I wasn't looking at nobody else. I don't know where everybody went. I didn't really care.
By the time you got there, the sun was out. It was pretty bright. It was almost warm, right?
Yeah, it was nice out.
It was nice.
Yeah, it came broke to be a nice day.
Did you notice anybody with an umbrella?
I remember somebody down past me to the right towards the viaduct. They had an umbrella, but what they were doing, I don't know. I've heard the theories of the umbrella man shooting somebody with an umbrella, but...
You don't believe that?
I don't believe that, not for 1 minute.
Why not?
It'd be kind of silly for somebody to take an umbrella where you can't even aim it. All you can do is point it. And you're still going to be shooting at a moving target, and it had to be a very small caliber because they didn't come in big calibers, and they were used basically for in-house operations, and you're right on top of the target when you use it. And 1963, the agency, which I'm referring to, the CIA, they had weapons basically based on umbrellas, like you could use it, walking canes. Some of them carried a small caliber round. You couldn't put a big caliber in there. To me, the weapon was strictly an in-house weapon where you had to be right on top of the target. There's no way you can stand out on a sidewalk and take an umbrella and point it and hit a moving target without aiming. I mean, this is a lot of fantasy here. I thought the umbrellas, when they come out with them, they had the little darts in them. They had the poison on the end of them where you could jab a guy going downstairs or in a house or in a room, any place where there's a lot of people moving and mulling around together. You could walk up with somebody and you could shoot fire small 22 caliber round into them. But as far as for somebody using an umbrella on the sidewalk and firing around, no, that's a lot of fantasy.
You parked the Chevrolet on Houston Street?
I'm not sure. It was right next to the Dow Tech building there, whichever street that would be. No, Houston. Houston Street's the one that's going up and down.
Houston Street's the one that runs in the Scuba Depositories over here and Dow Tech's buildings over here.
Right.
Did you park on that street?
I parked on the street right next to it, yeah.
Was it a head-in parking, or was it a parking lot, or did you straight
well,
in?
Well, you want to call it parking space, parking lot, parking aisle, whatever you want to call it. The place cars were parked there.
A row of cars.
Row of cars. Kind of backed it in and parked it so he could have access to the trunk.
So you're backed in, so your
yes,
front end's
elongated. Well, no, the front is pointing forward.
Yeah,
forward
towards the
yeah.
street.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting ahead here a minute, mm-hmm. but when you left, you turned right.
When I come out of there, I made a right-hand turn.
On to Houston.
Leaving on Houston. Yeah, going north.
Okay. All right, so that's where you parked it.
That's where I parked the car.
Now, so as you walked past, did you just walk straight to the car?
I went straight to the car. I didn't bother paying no attention to nobody. I went right to the car. What was going on around me, I don't know. I can't tell you what passed me. I can't tell you who was looking at me, and I can't tell you how many people was around. I had one thing on my mind. Anybody that approaching me with the determination to stop me, to question me, detain me, whatever you want to call it, or anything else. All I want to do now is reach my destination, which is the car, put the case in the back seat there on the floor, like Chuck and me already have figured out. I'm going to get in the car, start it up, drive away.
Was the car empty when you got there?
No, sir. When I got to the car, Charles Nicoletti was in the front seat. Johnny Roselli was in the back seat.
And
there's only two seats in the front. We had the bucket seats in it.
So as soon as you got in the car, you just started up?
As soon as I got in the car, opened the door, set the case in the back, was behind the front seat, got right in the car, with the ignition, and gone.
Anybody say anything at that point?
Nobody said nothing to me. At that point, we pull out. And as we went down the street heading for the intersection, the only thing that was said to me was, Mr. Nicoletti asked me, he said, Jimmy, don't you think you overreacted? I said, what do you mean? He said, do you think you fired too fast? And I told him, I said, I fixed to lose my fill of fire. Either I shoot then or I put it in a brief, put it in my gun case and I leave. I said, I had one choice. I said, at this point, you told me we were going for a headshot. There's been no headshot. I said, I'm just following my orders. I said, I didn't want to explain to you why I didn't shoot.
Did he say anything to that?
And that was the end of it. And he told me, he said, at this intersection, he says, make a left and pull up at the gas station. We get down there, he says, we're getting out, we're getting in another car there. And I said, okay. I pulled up, parked, they got out of the car. He said, I'll see you in Chicago. And that was the only thing that was said.
Did you take that as criticism?
I took it as criticism, naturally.
Did he criticize you very often?
No. The only thing was he asked me if I thought I overreacted.
You told him no, and he accepted
it? He accepted it. As the motorcade's coming down, I've got my target in the scope. My primary target is lined up, and I'm waiting. And like I say, we're going for a headshot. I don't want to fire this. I have to. At this point, I'm fixing to lose my fuel of fire. I took my shot. When I took my shot, and I knelt back down to the briefcase, I ejected the one casing in there. I picked up another live round, put it in, and closed the bowl on it. I took this shell casing as it come out to the briefcase. I put it in my mouth, tasted the sulfur from it. Love the taste of sulfur, by the way. Closed the briefcase up, and as I stood up, I did something I shouldn't have done, but I did do it. I took the shell casing, I bit down on it. I took it out, and I looked at it, and I set it on the stocky fence. And there was an indentation from my teeth on the shell casing on the ridge by the orifice. And I left it sitting on the stockade fence there. And I walked away. Well, you got to understand, when you're young, you're cocky, everything is indestructible to you, you know. Nothing can go wrong. And you got to be a strong believer in all that. I mean, you know, you're infallible. And I did that because we did a few other jobs, and we did some. I might put a quarter on the forehead, and we put them in the ground. You know, we might bury them somewhere. Lay a quarter on the head. Two-bit gambler. Might put a dime and a nickel in each eye socket, a nickel in one eye, dime in the other one. You know, nickel and dime thief, stuff like
that. Would you say that was kind of your calling card?
More, you might say that. Chuck, Mr. Nicoletti would laugh at me when I do things like that. And, hey, you know, we got to let them know what they got here for, you know. To me, it was a symbol. You say it, calling card, trait, whatever you want to do. He used to laugh at me over it. He told me, Jimmy, just you do the job, you do it, and forget about it.
Would Mr. Nicoletti have been okay with you doing this in the plaza?
Oh, if he would have known I did that in the Dealey Plaza, right now he'd probably be turning over in his grave for me doing something that stupid.
Yeah. Right.
But Mr. Nicoletti criticized me one other time. Matter of fact, one time, I won't get into the details, but we had somebody in the trunk, and I stopped and bought a canary because this guy was a real snitch. And I come out of the dime store with a canary. I broke its neck because I wanted to leave the canary in the guy's mouth. And he gave me firm instructions. Don't you ever do anything like that again when we've got something in the trunk.
Really?
You know, it's highly uncalled for in reality.
Jimmy, I'm sure you're aware that they have found two 22 shell casings.
I've heard that. I've heard that.
Have you got any speculation, any idea of where a second 222 shell casing is?
I have no idea whatsoever. I fired one shot only. I ejected the shell casing. Mine was a Remington cartridge, manufactured prior to 1963. I bit it. I set it on the stockade fence. I had no empty shell casings for a 222 with me at all.
This shell casing, by the way, was found not in the exact spot where you left it, a little bit further at the other side of the fence.
Well, I look at it this way. Whoever was searching, somebody up to looking, anybody could have looked at it. They could have thrown it over there. Somebody could have stepped on it. Maybe somebody didn't want it found. Who knows? Yeah. They didn't want to carry anything away from there in case they got stopped. Maybe they just stepped on it, buried it in the ground. I don't really know. I know where I put it. That's all I know.
The guns that you brought to Dallas, was the fireball the only fireball?
No, sir, it wasn't.
You had another fireball?
No, I only had one fireball. But I had a couple of rifles in the car. I had a shotgun in the car. I had a couple of other handguns. I brought down probably half a dozen different weapons.
Well, my question, though, is that was the only 222?
That was the only 222 round. Like I said, I had a total of six rounds, okay? I got six rounds for the Remington fireball. I have no empty casings there. The other casings that I brought down with that, I had six special loads. But the rounds that I fired were standard rounds, and I had no empty casings with me. Those were disposed about by Mesquite. I didn't leave them where I test fired them. I picked them up and got rid of them later. I made sure they couldn't be found. I didn't want anybody to match anything up to the weapon. But with the fireball, there's no way they're going to match a ballistics for the simple reason the shell fragmentates. But you've still got the firing pin that's going to strike the primer on the end of the shell casing. So, and a lot of times, if you've got a weapon where you can match ballistics on, you want to melt the barrel down if you've used it and some kind of a job like that or whatever, like, you know, local hit or something. Also, you want to take out the pin to firing pin, because you don't want that discovered either to match up with the primer.
Because they can match them.
Yes, they can.
Do you have any idea about the possibility of other hit teams in the plaza that
I've heard different stories about different teams there, different people shooting, this and that. To my knowledge, and to my knowledge only, I never knew of another hit team that was in the area for Kennedy that day. If there's another team there, I have no knowledge of it whatsoever.
But it could
be. Anything is possible. Anything's possible. It could have been another team there. But what I'm stating is this. As far as I know, from what I was involved in, Charles Nicoletti, Johnny Roselli was with him, because Johnny Roselli was like his lookout, whatever, pick up any shell casing that he ejects from the rifle. We don't want to leave shell casings on the floor. Mr. Nicoletti didn't want to be running around looking behind chairs or desks. Where's the casing? Where's the casing? You got somebody there picking them up as they come out. And like I say, I never saw Charles Nicoletti pull the trigger. But he was the shooter, from what I understand, with him.
You saw Richard Kane there. Could he have been a shooter?
Richard Kane. He was on location, and so was a guy by the name of Milwaukee Phil. His name is Philip Alarezo. Believe it or not, Alarezo. But if there was another hit team, because they faded from the scene, I don't honestly know. I can't say yes. I can't say no.
Do you think Lee Harvey Oswald fired any shots that day?
Lee Harvey Oswald never fired a shot.
That was James Files. He's the JFK assassin, part of the Chicago Mafia. He was a hitman trained by the U.S. 82nd Airborne Division. And we'll have more from him in future weeks. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download that podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week. You just heard from James Files and that interview by Wim Dankbar. Also, Joanna Blythman, the author of Swallow This, Food Industry's Darkest Secrets, and also What to Eat. And she's an investigative journalist. Also, we heard from Kevin Wilson. He's a Bristol student who's just come back from Georgia. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk is their website. Also via Volunteering Bristol, with all sorts of other volunteering opportunities too, on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the National Volunteering do-it.org website. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Yes, folks, I can understand their feelings because they are about to play sideways through the sewers of the Strand on a Sunday afternoon.
Who's that, though?
Sideways through the sewers of the Strand will be our honeymoon. Ankle deep, folks, in sludge, dear, we'll walk hand in hand. They do say that the sewers of the Strand are the finest in the land. Sideways through the sewers of the Strand will be paradise for two. Who cares if the atmosphere is blue? 'Cause there's a nothing wrong,
yes,
with a good old British bong. Sideways through the sewers of the Strand with you. La da fee ba da hee ba ya da boy ho. Ah, my darling little bride, we met by accident, folks. She ran over me in a tram. Her name was Beulah. Mine was Jim. I was glad they called me Jim, folks, because that was my name. I found out that she'd been going out with an Irish dentist called Phil McCavity. He walked with a pronounced limp. L-I-M-P, pronounced limp, folks. Oh, the worry turned me gray. This gave me a strange appearance as I was bald at the time. The first time I met her was late, early one morning in spring. There was a heavy dew on the grass. He'd just been thrown out of a synagogue for eating during the sermon. I told her, darling, let me take you away from the squalor you live in and live in the squalor I live in. So we were married in the spring, folks. We had the reception in the pond. There was plenty to drink, folks. And then off we went, folks. Sideways through those naughty sewers of the naughty Strand will be a paradise for two, not one, but two, folks. Who cares if the atmosphere is blue? Who said that? 'Cause there's nothing wrong, is there, with a good old British bong? Sideways through the sewers of the Strand with you. I don't mean maybe.
Wait a minute.
There was a baboon who one afternoon said, I think I will fly to the sun. So with two great palms strapped to his arms, he started his take-off run. Started his take-off run. Mile after mile, he galloped in style, but never once left the ground. You're running too slow, said a passing crow. Try reaching the speed of sound. Reaching the speed of sound. So he put on a spurt. My God, how it hurt. The soles of his feet caught on fire. There were great clouds of steam as he raced through a stream, but he still didn't get any higher. Still didn't get any higher. Racing on through the night, both his knees caught alight, and smoke billowed out from his rear. Quick to
his aid came a fire brigade, who chased him for over a year, chased him for over a year. Many moons passed by, did Baboon ever fly? Did he ever get to the sun? I just heard today that he's well on his way. He'll be passing through Acton at one. Passing through Acton at one.